votes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address three issues concerning the trial court's damage award. Turning first to the court's errors in its award of lost profits between January of 1990 and July of 1992. The trial court exceeded its authority when it revised Fidelity's pre-breach macro rate. This error tainted the trial court's subsequent findings that Fidelity would not have been a troubled thrift but for the breach. Fidelity was a troubled four-rated institution before the breach when it had all of its goodwill capital. And it would have been a troubled four-rated institution in a non-breach world where it retained its contractual capital, which was less than its total regulatory capital. The trial court exceeded its authority and committed clear error in concluding otherwise.
Wasn't it more that the court discounted the macro rather than, as you stated it, revised it or somehow disclaimed it completely? It actually just discounted its evidence.
Your Honor, I don't think that's correct, because the court actually calculated a 2.6 macro rating that it's considered would have been the proper macro rating in 1987. That's at page 12 and page 30 of the court's opinion, or the appendix. So the court actually calculated 2.6.
I think they calculated that. They merely noted that that was going to be an average. They didn't even say the average was the necessary way of reaching it. Wasn't the court really making a rather common sense observation that on the cusp of FIREA, there had to be some effect on all of your assessments of capital when you know that the government's about to drop the bomb?
Your Honor, responding to your notion that there was some sort of problem with capital in that 87 report, macro rating, it was rated a 2 in 1987. So the capital was rated very highly. It's the asset quality, the four rating asset quality, which drove the overall macro rating. And the court discounted that fact, that it was the asset quality troubles that was causing the strip to be a 4 when it had all of its goodwill. It was a 4 prior to that. And pursuant to RB3A-1,
but
when
everybody knows it's about to lose that goodwill, and that is a tremendous life, a tremendous anchor on asset value, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. Goodwill does not affect asset value whatsoever. The notion, too, is if you're talking about when was the time...
Can I just stop you on that point? There's a suggestion here that you could waive off the debt loans against regulatory capital. You suggest, I think at page 49 of your brief, the testimony shows that that's not possible. Is it possible to write off bad loans against regulatory capital, or is it not possible?
Your Honor, first with regard to the timing of that, it's not possible to simply say, today I want to write off all my loans, and that's a key part of their argument. So at least set that aside, Mr. Kennedy testified to that effect. You have to write off when the loss is probable and a reasonable estimate can be made. So you can't preemptively write off your bad loans.
Really responding to my
okay,
question.
I just
my question
say-
is, you know, you can certainly write off bad loans against tangible capital. Can you write them off against regulatory capital? Can regulatory capital be used for that purpose?
Your Honor, I believe it's a two-step process. The first process is that when you have a loan loss reserve that needs to be established, you cannot set that off against goodwill. You have to set that off against earnings. Now, when you have a charge to your earnings, does that affect your capital? Yes. But it affects your earnings first. So it's a charge against earnings. And what you would see with this bank did, in 1987 even, they, before FIREA, when they were looking to realize the losses on their property on their loans, they actually sold assets to realize a profit in order to cover the losses from the bad assets. That's at page 3022. So that process is first, and Mr. Powderly testified to that fact, that goodwill cannot be used for loan loss reserves. That's at page 10714.
I'm still confused, and maybe it's because I don't understand the account. Even without reaching earnings, if you decide that your loan portfolio is overvalued by $100 million and it needs to be written down, could you then say we're going to write it down on the balance sheet and we're going to use another asset to create the reserve for the loan? So am I not understanding?
Your Honor, if I understand your question, is this a two-step process? One is, first, if you were, you said suddenly we need to get $100 million in reserves, then you're going to have $100 million hit to your earnings. So that's going to be your real, you know, obviously tangible earnings. It could be accretion of income. But first it goes to earnings, and then second, yes, it goes to capital. So you would have a hit to capital. But the first step is it goes to your earnings. Earnings flow into capital, and it would hit your capital. If you had no earnings, of course, it would hit your capital directly.
The capital, and you use the regulatory capital to take the hit as opposed to tangible capital.
Not for the loan loss reserves as an initial matter. As the initial matter, it goes on your earnings.
Let me ask you a question again. I'm afraid this is into the accounting, but the court was focusing on, as I read the opinion, two things that are going on simultaneously, and I want to tease them apart. One is the macro, and the other is insolvency. Now, I take it your position with regard to the macro is the court is simply wrong in saying that at least as the initial period beginning in January 1990, that the macro would have changed. The macro was set as of the previous fall, and there wasn't another evaluation for a while yet, and they were stuck with a 4. That's at least in part your position, I take it, right?
Correct.
All right. And the court is saying, in the absence of Faria Fidelity, this is at page 28, Fidelity would not have had a low macro rating and would therefore not have been a troubled threat. And you say that's simply false because the macro rating would have continued and wouldn't have been affected for other reasons as well by Faria.
Correct.
All right. Now, the court then says, and I think this is with respect to the problem that Faria, as of the date of effectiveness, put this institution into insolvency, that insolvency itself had certain consequences, serious consequences for the institution. Now, as I understand it, the macro 4 put the institution in a situation that it was subject to RB3A1. Insolvency resulted in the imposition of a capital plan, if I understand those two.
That's correct.
Operating at the same time.
That's correct.
Was the capital plan more restrictive than the RB3A1 restrictions?
Your Honor, with respect to the amount of growth, the answer is no. What they were both entitled to is the growth to the level of interest earned.
Yeah.
And so in both of those, they have the exact same provision in terms of the language. You can grow to the amount of your interest earnings. For instance, if your deposits are earning, let's say, 5% a year, the typical notion is that your depositors will keep that money in, and you can grow 5% without any further restrictions.
But if we agree that FIREA put this institution into insolvency, are you saying then that it doesn't matter that they were under the capital plan as long as they were subject to RB3A1?
Correct, and that's exactly the testimony of the regulators. They expressly testified.
So there's no incremental detriment to the institution by virtue of its insolvency, is what you're saying?
Not at the period of time where their loans are this bad. Our argument is by 1992, their loan quality is improved to the degree that then the capital does have an effect over the asset quality. But the asset quality until 92 is such that the regulators testified repeatedly they would have rated it 4 and they would have restricted the growth. And to follow the asset quality, the classified assets were $81 million in 1987. That's at 3,042. They went up to $97.6 million in 1989, November of 89. That's at 200,332. They finally sort coming down to 91, but still higher than 87. That's at $86 million. That's at 200,662. By 92, they're down to 75 million. Finally, the first time in 5 years, they've been below the level in 87. And that's when our regulator said, yes, at that point in time, from that examination forward, yes, they were restricted by the loss of the capital, and that's why we're not getting appealed the periods of time until between 92 and 95 with respect to the lost profits there.
Could much of my time. For a moment, just to, so that I understand here. As I understand it, you're contending that the Court of Federal Claims couldn't second guess the four rating that was given in 87, 88. And let's assume that we were to agree hypothetically that you're correct, that the court can't re-examine that rating. Do you dispute that the court can look to the future and ask the question, would the four rating have continued? Agree that they could do that?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Okay. So what's the testimony that we have on whether the four rating would have continued? I read the parts of the record. I understand that there was clear testimony from the regulators, from the government, that the four rating would have continued.
Correct.
That nothing would have happened to change that. Was there testimony on the other side that the Court of Federal Claims could properly have relied on to conclude that the four rating would not continue?
No, Your Honor, none whatsoever. And that the four rating would have continued even a good moment score. That's a 10.2774-76, Mr. Vigna. Mr. Amon testified repeatedly of that. 10.4765-67, 10.4612-16, 10.4740-41, Mr. Amon and Mr. Albanese, 10.4164. Your Honor,
when you say would have continued, are you saying even after the supplemental or the subsequent reviews that occurred, I guess, exactly 92, is that right? And then, well, take 90. And was 92 the next date for one of these?
It was 89, 91, and 92. On the review,
the examination, yeah. Full review that resulted in 91, but that didn't actually come out until later, I take it. I mean,
they always come a few months later.
Okay, all right. When you say would have continued, you mean would have continued in 91 and 92?
I'm saying
not just after the 90, but prior to the next review.
The goodwill, even with the goodwill restored, the testimony was they would have been a four-rated institution in 1990, 1991, and through the middle of 1992, until they got that 92 report of examination, where finally their asset quality has improved since relative to 1987.
Is there a suggestion that there wouldn't have been another rating after 1988 until 1991?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
When?
There was another rating
after. Next rating event. Assuming that let's assume hypothetically, the Court of Federal Claims was bound by the 87 to 88 rating, when would there have been another rating of this bank to determine what the correct rating was?
It was November of 89 was the next one.
Okay, so there was one coming up immediately, which wasn't, was that rating actually made or not?
Yeah, the rating was rated as a 5 overall, but in the.
But because of 5 rating.
The capital, yes, the capital would have made it a 5, but regulator testifies because the asset quality was going to be a 4 in pursuant to Article 3.
But 5 wasn't in effect at that point, right?
That's correct, but I think that they discounted, they recognized that the capital. This was in November of 1989, so by the time the exams finish, they have gone into the post-party period. You know, my time is, I need to, if I...
You may preserve the remainder of your time.
But, Your Honor, I have to bring up two other issues, so I just have to quickly bring these up. One is the failure to account for increased costs. There were salary costs and advertising costs that the court ignored in its award. It recognized that those costs existed. It just did not calculate those in the non-breach world. And secondly, the court award failed to account for the loss of non-contractual capital. The court did not address that. It was $27 million of non-contractual capital was lost with FIREA. Plaintiffs argue that we didn't make this argument below. We did. It's page 31 to 33 of our reply brief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll restore Mr. Roberson's entire rebuttal time, 5 minutes, and if you'll give Mr. Eisenhardt an additional 4 minutes, so we'll have equal time if he needs to use that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Eisenhardt, you may proceed.
Frank Eisenhardt, representing the story of federal savings and loan. Judge Bryson, I'd like to start by addressing the question you posed to Mr. Roberson concerning the applicability of RB3A1 post-FIREA. RB3A1 was never actually applied to Fidelity post-FIREA. When FIREA hit Fidelity, the operable regulations required Fidelity, if it was going to stay open at all because it was severely undercapitalized, to submit a capital plan, which Fidelity did. Right. And that's what Fidelity operated under post-FIREA.
But the question is, would it have, one question is, would it have been subject to effectively the same constraints as the capital plan under RB3A1, which I gather would have applied if they had been solvent, but before?
The government's argument is that if you create a hypothetical world in which FIREA has occurred, but Fidelity, for some reason, has not lost its capital. I think they say Fidelity was grandfathered.
Right.
They say then RB3A1 would have applied and
would. Do you dispute that if FIREA hadn't been passed, that RB3A1 would have applied to this bank?
Well, recognize, Judge, like RB3A1 was a post-FIREA regulation. So I'm not even sure if FIREA hadn't passed that there would have been an RB3A1.
But that doesn't matter because there was no contractual obligation to the government not to promulgate RB3A1.
That's true. And I think the way to look at how RB3A1 might have applied in this hypothetical world, there are really two overarching considerations.
Well, wait a second. What I'm trying to understand is whether you're contesting the government's basic point. They're saying RB3A1 and the capital plan had the same consequences if there was a 4 rating under the RB3A1. Do you dispute that?
With respect to growth restrictions, they're right.
Okay.
Both of them would have allowed growth only to the extent of interest accrued.
So do you then agree that the Court of Federal Claims had to determine that there would not have been the same restrictions as a result of the asset problem in order for you to prevail?
The government, and this is an affirmative defense, and the Court of Appeals, the Court of Federal Claims, would have had to conclude that the government had presented sufficient evidence that RB3A1 would have applied, that there would have been a 4 rating, and that growth would therefore have been restricted.
But if they established that they would have had a 4 rating, the government wins, right?
If they established that they would have had a 4 rating because of problem real estate loans, then they have a good argument that RB3A1 would have applied. They never...
And that you shouldn't recover the damages, right?
That would have impacted the lost profits model, yes. But there
so you're
are...
You're not disputing that the affirmative defense exists in theory. That's correct, right?
Correct, I am not.
So the question is whether they established as a matter of fact.
Whether they established it as a matter of fact, correct.
And the question there is, would the 4 rating have continued after 87 to 88, correct?
Actually, you have to take one step back from that. I think there is a substantial evidentiary question whether the 4 rating in 1988 resulted from the problem real estate loans. I don't think that that's at all clear. Judge Wheeler, in his opinion...
Well, how can the Court of Federal Claims second-guess the regulatory determination that was made in 87 to 88?
They can't second-guess the regulatory determination.
They cannot.
And I don't think Judge Wheeler ever purported to do
they
that.
They cannot second-guess it.
They cannot. But there is nothing in the documentary record of that 4 rating in 1988 that says this is due to problem real estate loans. The documentary record simply says the institution has problem with real estate loans. We're rating them a 4 for assets and a 4 overall. It doesn't say what drove the rating. And in fact, the evidence of what drove that rating in 1988 is all over the map. Recognize that the
regulator came in and testified the 4 rating would have continued, right?
They said the 4 rating would have continued because of problem real estate loans.
Okay,
however,
so what's the contrary testimony?
Their own testimony contradicts it. First of all, the rating prior to 1988, which was in 1985, the assets were rated exactly the same. They were rated a 4. However, the overall rating was a 3. If, as the government contends, the asset rating drives the overall rating. Why would they have been a 3 in 1985? The only rating that changed between 85 and 88 was management. They were rated a 2 in management in 1985. That dropped to a 3 in 88. One of the government's own witnesses, Mr. Albanese, testified that in his view of the five factors, management was the most important. And that's the one that changed.
That sounds like a lawyer argument. I mean, they testified that there was a poor rating. Was there contrary testimony that there wouldn't have been a poor rating?
The main witness who testified that the four rating was given, first of all, understand that the examiner in charge of the 87 exam, which resulted in the 88 rating, was never called. So we have no testimony from the one person who would have known as to what drove that rating. Mr. Amond, who was not involved in the exam, he was a field supervisor, said, I think looking at the exam report, it must have been driven by the real estate loans. But then he said, well, you'd also have to take the management rating into account, too. So he's ambivalent as to whether it's real estate or real estate and management. Mr. Albanese, his supervisor, says management's most important, and management's the one that actually went down. Mr. Vigna, who's the regional manager, who's at the top of the heap, says in his view, capital is the most important. Capital is the one that's going to drive the rating. So their own evidence on this point of what caused the rating in 1988 is inconsistent. Likewise, you have to determine what would have happened in this parallel world post-Faria. And there are really two overarching considerations there. The first is recognize that this regulation was completely discretionary. Government treats this as though this is a mandatory thing. If you have a 4 or a 5 rating, you're not going to be permitted to go and to grow, end of debate. That's not the way it worked. This is totally discretionary with the regulator.
There are waivers that need to provide.
The director of the OTS region, which in this case is Angelo Vigna, who is director of the Northeast region, has the power to grant a waiver.
Was there any testimony?
Pardon?
I'm sorry, was there any testimony that there would have been a waiver?
Interestingly, the government, whose defense this was, never asked him that question, but they asked him a question very close to it that gives some real insight into it.
So the answer is there wasn't any testimony?
There was no question, there was no clear question, would you have granted a waiver?
One way or the other.
One way or the other. The question that was asked, though, is I think, very important. There is a thing called risk control arbitrage, which is a technique that is more complex and more risky than what Fidelity was actually doing. Fidelity was buying mortgage-backed securities and earning a very good profit on them, and that's really the way they grew themselves back into capital compliance. Risk control arbitrage takes it a step further. In that, you're hedging your positions using mainly interest rate swaps. It was a recognized technique. That would have been affected by RB3A12. They would not have been able to do a risk control arbitrage. The government lawyers asked Mr. Vigna, would you have allowed them to do risk control arbitrage? Now, he would have had to grant, if he was, the answer to that was yes, he would have had to grant an exception. He says, yeah, I'd sure have to consider it so long as it didn't add any undue risk to the balance sheet. Well, if he would have had to consider risk control arbitrage as long as it didn't add undue risk, he certainly would have had to contribute what they were actually doing. And the question then becomes,
the
why?
The judge didn't make any finding about waivers, did he? I didn't see
no, that. He did not make any finding about waivers.
So it seems to me quite speculative for us to say, well, there's your answer, it's waivers.
Well, I don't know that it's any more speculative to say they wouldn't have done it, they would have waived it, than it is to say they would have done it. The question really becomes, what motive would they possibly have had to restrict Fidelity using RB3A1? This is not the growth that they were positing, the growth on which the loss damages model is based, is not going back into commercial real estate again. It's not going off into some new field. It is a modest incremental expansion of a program that they're already doing in the real world that's a complete success, that's earning them money, that's run by a guy who the regulators describe as the best CFO we ever came across, who Mr. Vigna, who had the power to grant the waiver, regarded as a genius at squeezing badly needed earnings out of the balance sheet without taking undue risk.
The court sets a 8.2% growth rate a year.
Yes, sir.
What justifies that percentage? I think it's discussed mostly on page 26 of the court's opinion, and it does list some high growth rates in some years where there was a very high inflation. Do those growth rates take the inflation out of the equation?
I believe they
actual
do.
Actual growth rates?
I can tell you the genesis for the 8% annual growth, which if you compound it comes out to something like 8.2, is that that's the figure that Dr. Kaplan used in his lost profits calculation. And there's pages and pages of testimony in Dr. Kaplan's testimony about why he used that. He said, I was looking for the most conservative growth rate I could find. You know, obviously realistic, but very conservative. I looked at the actual growth rates, and they were generally well above that figure, but they issued a business plan in 1988, which was the last business plan before FIREA, in which they said, it is our plan to grow the institution at an annual rate of 8 to 10%. And he said, for my lost profits model, I took the bottom end of that range. There was also testimony.
Why didn't the court award the offsets? Salary reductions, marketing.
There's absolutely no evidence of the salary reductions, the salary reduction of marketing.
Well, you had to reduce the staff by 25%, so there's evidence, isn't there, that that's going to save you some money.
The only
payroll goes down.
The only they presented no testimony, factual or expert, on this issue. The only evidence they pointed to after the fact in the post-trial briefing and on appeal is a budget that Fidelity prepared in which they budgeted certain marketing and advertising expenses. And the testimony was that because of the restrictions the capital plan put on them, a lot of this never got done. But the government's own testimony is that these budget figures are simply predictions of what might happen, and they bear no relation to reality. They never tried to tie the personnel deductions into marketing and advertising. This is simply something they seized on after the fact. There's not really any evidence of it. The other restrictions, they say that there would have been a period of no growth in the period of time just before Fidelity converted from into stock form, and of course in that conversion achieved capital compliance. The evidence again doesn't support that. What Mr. West, who's the chief financial officer, said is, looking at that period of time, we didn't plan to grow very much in that period of time because we wanted to be careful to stay within the agreed parameters for the capital conversion. We certainly wanted to make sure we didn't grow in a way that would put us out of capital compliance, or at least put us over our budget. And bear in mind that Dr. Kaplan testified that when he chose 2% a quarter as his model in the lost profits claim, he wasn't predicting that they would grow like clockwork 2% every quarter. He's saying that's a reasonable, conservative number to use. There would have been some quarters where they grew by much more than 2%. There surely would have been some quarters when they grew less than 2%. But I think overall, 2% per quarter is a very conservative figure to use, and that's the reason why he used it. The government has gotten the benefit of his conservatism using the 8% figure. They shouldn't be allowed to go back then and say, aha, you wouldn't have hit your 2%. Growth in this particular quarter you've got to reduce it for that.
If we can return for a moment to the macro issue, what is the, give me a quick summary of the evidence that as to the 89 to 90 macro rating, that was affected by the enactment of FIDO?
Well, I don't think there was ever any dispute that the actual macro ratings post-FIREA were driven by capital.
Okay, but I guess my first question is that 1189 through 790, I guess, was the period of that macro analysis and ultimate rating. Did that incorporate post-FIREA numbers?
Yes.
Okay, so the only immediate pre-FIREA macro rating was the 87 through 88.
Correct.
And that was the 4.
That was the 4.
All right. And then it went down to 5, and you say that was driven by capital. The fact that that was capital and that incorporated the post-FIREA numbers. Not just a projection or an anticipation of FIREA, but actual FIREA numbers, correct?
That's correct. The first post-FIREA, that first post-FIREA macro rating, I think everybody agrees, was driven by capital. They were capital deficient.
What was the evidence that the 87 to 88 rating was in any way affected by FIREA?
The only evidence of it is the timing. Recognize that these exam reports, particularly in the pre-FIREA days, frequently came in a year or more after the actual exam began. So that rating was delivered to them, I believe it was around September of 1988, even though the exam began in 87.
So there was no testimony that the rating was affected by FIREA?
No, there was no rating. There was no evidence. There was no direct evidence of that.
So that 4 was in place until it was substituted with a 5 in 1990, July of 1990, is that correct?
That would be correct.
So the RB3A1 would have been in effect until July of 1990, no matter what.
Unless wait. If they chose to apply,
right.
Let's assume
that since nobody said a word about waiver, that we won't look at waiver. That would have simply locked the institution in to the no growth provision or the restricted growth provision of RB3A1 until July. At that point, the capital difference in the non-breach world might have produced a different number. Right?
If there had been an RB3A1 and if they had chosen to apply it based on that 4 rating, yes,
okay.
what you say would have happened, would have happened. The last thing I'll take in my last 30 seconds or so is this whole issue of the lost profits award should have been reduced because of the so-called non-contractual capital. The issue here, of course, is that they had another acquisition where they had supervisory goodwill from it, but there was no contract with the government. That goodwill arose simply by normal accounting standards. And the easy answer here is that you don't reduce the lost profits calculation to account for that non-contractual capital because it was never a part of it in the first place. When Dr. Kaplan modeled the lost profits claim, he modeled it based only on the contractual capital that was lost. So that non-contractual capital never figured into his claim to begin with, and there's no reason why it should be taken out.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenhart. Mr. Roberson, you have 5 minutes of your rebuttal on this floor.
Thank you. I guess what I'm going to do is sort of count back from the order of his argument in terms of points I want to respond to. First, the plaintiff said that RBA3A1 was not provided to the institution, was provided to the institution. It's at 200-471-74. It's provided in January of 1990. And it indicated that it was going to be applied to the institution. The second thing is the notion that plaintiff argued that there was some confusion about whether the 4 rating 87 was based on bad loans. The court expressly found And it really can't be argued that the four rating was based on its bad loans. It's at page 12 of the appendix. The court found that the bad commercial loans caused the four rating in 1987.
Is there any reason that that's pertinent other than to extrapolate into the reason that the later ratings may have also been lower than the plaintiff's claim?
Well, that's the point.
But that's the only point. I mean, well, the rating was what it was, right?
Correct.
Therefore, both sides are stuck with what the rating was in 87.
Right.
It wasn't affected by FIREE at all.
That's correct. And there's no doubt, there was 100 pages in that report of examination dealing with the bad loans. They only got worse in time, as I've already pointed out. With respect to the notion that in 85 they received a 4 in asset quality, but I got a 3 overall rating. In 85 their asset quality was nowhere near as bad. We're talking about magnitudes of multiplication, how quickly their loans degenerated. In fact, they doubled between 86 and 87 to show how fast they went bad, and then they continue on into 89. So the notion that there's a comparable with 85 is simply not true. The plaintiffs argue that we didn't call the 87 examiner, we called his supervisor, Mr. Amen, who was widely looked on as the person with the most experience overlooking the thrift. He had done their 85 examination. He became the field manager who's a supervisor of the examiners in charge. He became an assistant director. He had his hands-on contact with that institution from the 85 period straight through to 95. And to give you the citations with respect to his qualifications and how people looked at him, Mr. Powerly testified at 10407 that he knew the bank very, very well. He and Mr. Vigna, Mr. Powerly had a high opinion of Amen and testified that Mr. Amen had the most hands-on experience, page 10661 to 62. And the court recognized that the regulators considered Mr. Amen one of the court recognized that the plaintiff's witnesses considered Mr. Amen to be one of the most competent regulators that they'd ever worked with. That's at page 17 of the joint appendix.
Now, I'm bothered by one thing, which neither one of you has addressed, and that is this testimony by Kaplan at 103177. Why isn't this contrary testimony that the 4 rating would not have continued? Are you familiar with that page?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
I
understand. Oh, I think I understand what his testimony was, Your Honor.
Do you have the appendix?
Yes, I do. But I think I know that side now that I'm thinking about it. And I think what he's saying is that, well, you know, regulatory capital would have given you flexibility. And that's the argument that the court actually uses otherwise. And that's an argument that, well, goodwill provides you with some flexibility, and therefore you could have somehow gotten away from your bad loans. And what Mr. Kaplan actually did was he relied on Mr. Powderly's testimony. He looked at that testimony carefully. And Mr. Powderly acknowledged that goodwill can't be used for loan loss reserves. It can't be used to fix up real estate that you've acquired. It can't be used to purchase other businesses. And there's a whole slew of things that goodwill cannot do with the real world to affect the market value of a loan, to affect the market value of a property, anything to do with the real world with respect to fixing up real estate. So there's sort of an ambiguity with respect to the notion of goodwill. Is goodwill same? I mean, of capital. Is goodwill the same thing as goodwill capital? No, it's not. Goodwill capital can't do some of these things that capital can do. So the testimony of Mr. Powell is off to begin with. Now, secondly, there is the notion that goodwill could have offered you more flexibility in the non-REIT world with dealing with your real estate owned. And if you have more capital and you have real estate owned, it may be that you can decide whether to not to hold a non-performing asset for a long period of time and then later decide to sell it. But that kind of flexibility is only after the fact of the loss. You have already taken your loss in your real estate owned. You've already written down the loan. So it doesn't...
Final thoughts for us, Mr. Roberts.
Your Honor, the bottom line is that this institution was troubled before FIREE because of its bad loans. The regulators couldn't avoid $30 million in losses before 87, and it had the same problems. It would have had the same problems in the non-rich world. Thank you, Your Honor. For the following reasons, we would like to...
I think we know what you want.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.